Good morning, all. If you're okay, I'm going to wander a bit. I want to be very clear. With this venue and being called a big library guy, a certain set of girth, I may have to break out into opera. But that's a warning. Trust me, that would not be good. It is wonderful to be here. Thank you very much. Learning about what's going on here in Sarasota and across the state, it's wonderful. I am now a Southerner. You can tell from the accent. I lived in Syracuse for about 28 years, and so people are like, so how's the South? I'm like, well, I'm not shoveling anything, so it's pretty good. It's very nice to be here. I will give you, in academia, of course, and given the sort of world, there's this discussion of safe spaces and trigger warnings. So I want to warn you that there are two points in this presentation that you will be tempted to leave. The first is the fact that this isn't my real title of my slide. It's this one. The second one, you'll know when it comes. But I promise this isn't going to be a political screed. It really isn't, because it's not about politics. But it is about, I think, an opportunity that we have. I am extraordinarily excited about the prospects for librarians and libraries in the current environment and where we move forward. We were just having a conversation in the wings, using all my theater lingo, about the idea that Sarah Beth used to be a journalist, and I happen to be an associate dean in a college of information communications with a sister school of journalism. And it's a really interesting moment for journalism. And once again, this is not a politics side, it's just a matter of, it's a different environment. And how we respond to it, and what we do about it, and how we connect to it, and all of these things, are really important. And for one reason or another, you can call it a desire for accountability, you can call it whatever you want, it's a time of testing that takes us to a real fundamental level of why are we doing this? What is our contribution to society? How do we play this? What do we do back and forth? And so it's from there that I want to talk today, because I want to get into the notion of our responsibilities to communities and our contributions and responsibilities to societies. Give you a few other sort of heads up. I'm going to use a couple of terms today, and I want to be clear about what I mean. First, I'm going to use the term community. Communities to me are, in essence, a group of people that have some shared definition. We live in a place. We work in a place. We are a profession. We are a hobby. And the other part, which is equally important, and particularly as I learned that Sarah Beth may have to sneak out of here to talk budget discussions, they have to allocate scarce resources, right? So we have to figure out tax dollars or tuition dollars. We have to figure out time. We have to figure out space. A lot of times we talk about libraries and we worry about budgets, and that's absolutely true. But more often than not, we're also worried about real estate. I was having a conversation back and forth. Maybe you saw a recent article, which I believe came out in the Miami Herald, about the new library in Homestead that was designed by, anyone see this one? I already heard a snicker. Designed by theme park designers. Now, on one hand, I am thrilled about the idea of a roller coaster in a library. It would be lovely if the roller coaster were there on purpose as opposed to sort of how we deal throughout the day and patrons in the seat of the bathrooms. But what bothered me about this concept, and it started this long discussion about quiet spaces and not quiet spaces, all these things, but it was the idea that somehow, if only we were entertaining, libraries would be relevant again. And everyone was reading it going, where have you been? You know, if you walk into libraries, you know, this idea of shushing and quiet, we know what we need to do and we know why we need to do it, but we don't always know how to get there. And a lot of it is, should libraries be quiet spaces? Should libraries be about books? Should libraries, right? This is how it's often phrased to us, friends, groups, boards, you get this on a regular basis. And the answer is, it depends. Right? That's not a good answer. We don't like that answer because it ultimately sounds like we don't know what we're talking about, but the truth is, it depends. You know, is this a community that needs a quiet space? Is this a community that needs a roller coaster? Is this a community that needs different things? And so what I want to talk about today is that connection to community, that talking about
how we come to those determinations. And really, back to this idea of this is potentially our finest hour, to prove not only our relevance and worry about our budget, but to really reinforce the role that we have in society and the vision we have for a better society. And so let's go through that.
So yes, we're going to talk a little bit about knowledge in the age of alternative facts, and I promised that this isn't political, and it's not. Because currently that Ludley alt facts phrase and that idea of truth-o-meters and checking politicians and checking all this stuff and the idea of fake news is out there. But in truth, this is not a new conversation in the least. And I'm not even talking about propaganda and journalism and yellow journalism. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying for the past 20 years, there's been a move away from the idea of authority and this idea of some objective truth that we're all in the business of. This is a slide from 2011. A group of us, and I know it's really tiny, but Andy Dillon, University of Texas, University of Denver, people at the Pratt Institute, Corinne Hill, who was at Dallas, is now at Chattanooga, Annie Norman, State Library of Delaware, Ann Craig, IMLS. We got together and we sort of said, all right, let's come up with a grand challenge. Grand challenge is the idea of some societal effect that we can bring about that's hard, but has great potential reward. The biggest model of a grand challenge is the idea of mapping the human genome. That what happened is the scientific, particularly the genetics and biology community together and said, if we could map the genome, if we could know how this human DNA is put together, we could do brand new things in medicine and new cures and all these other things. And this was the day when it would take, you know, days to sample a little itty-bitty part of DNA. But they said, if we could do it, amazing things would happen. And rather than, what was nice about the grand challenge is they didn't say, all right, we're going to do it this way. They sort of said, here's the challenge. Go figure it out. And it became this really interesting competition. And at the end of that, not only had we mapped the human genome, but we'd accelerated the speed of how you do DNA sampling. We'd created whole new tools for biologists for doing genetic analysis. And it did happen. We began to be able to find, for example, certain genes that are more indicative of breast cancer. We found certain genetic anomalies that we could diagnose earlier. And it had other unintended consequences. Now, we could do DNA sampling in crime labs and in courts in hours versus days and days and days, and the accuracy could be increased. So we got together and said, what's the grand challenge? What do we have in the library field? Once again, this is not how do we have a better break room? And this certainly was not roller coasters. This was the idea of not about us for a difference, but what we could do to help society. What is the thing that libraries, and we'll get back to that word in a minute, could do that could help our communities and our society? And in doing that, what we began talking about was, well, we have this information infrastructure, we got all to it. But the one thing that came out of it was, how do we accept multiple ways of coming to a solution? Truth by consensus. In 2011, we were already talking about the idea of truth by consensus. This idea that we could look at communities, they could look at the same facts, they could look at the same information, they could look at the same evidence, that they could come to very different conclusions. And this, once again, was part of a much broader conversation. You know, we talk about fake news and alternative facts now, but if anyone survive an English degree here? I put up postmodern. There are three trigger warnings in this one. That would be the second one. Right? This idea that when you read a text, because, you know, I was in eighth grade once, I read the book, I was told what it meant. And now the idea that, wait, I can bring meaning to it, and maybe they can be interpreted different ways, and hey, what is the intention here? We began the idea of deconstruction, we began the idea of critique, we began the idea of looking at power structures. I mean, it was a very complex, very divisive, very new way of thinking about texts, about information, about interpreting society, about how we would do anthropology and sociology. Constructivism. In education, we began to look at education differently. Let's face it, while I look brilliant on a pseudo Supreme Court floor, By the way, it's the only job that I'm still running for. I did want to campaign to be Librarian of Congress, but they removed the lifetime appointment. I said, no, I'm not into that. I have tenure. This idea of constructivism is, this is not the ideal learning environment. It's great for sort of inspiration, it's great for presentation, it's great to sort of do overviews, but if you want to actually learn how to do something, this is not it, right? It's getting your hands dirty, it's trying it, it's making things happen. That idea of Justin Henke, who was at Chattanooga, is now in Pennsylvania Library, when he had a 3D makerspace, and he bought a 3D printer, he ran the youth area, the teens and youth area. And rather than going to a training session, or rather than hiding in the back room as he began to assemble that, what he did was he went right into the middle of the floor, opened the box, and started working on it in the middle of the floor. And as teens and people would walk by, he'd say, hey, want to help me? Want to try this? He said at one point, he said they literally, he did not realize, nor was it the instruction, when they had to take a hammer and chisel to the plastic that had built around the print heads. He said, this is not right. But he was willing to do that in the middle of the floor. He was willing to demonstrate that he was going to model learning and the learning that he wanted other people to do. I talked to a group of librarians, the Robot Test Kitchen. Great group, if you have a chance to look at it. And the Robot Test Kitchen were librarians where all these maker bots and makey makeys and robots and all this other stuff was coming out. They wanted to talk about how they could use it in teen services. And what they got is they got a bunch of librarians, and sort of the physical version was, on this side were librarians who loved this stuff and would stay up till 2 in the morning and make it work. And then over here was the, oh, I don't think so. And they got together, there were four of them, and what they would do is they would get a piece of technology and the four of them would come in and say, all right, even I can do this, right? Or, okay, this is even a pain for me. And they began looking at it. But that group, when we were talking and working with them, they said the hardest thing they ever did in their professional career was this, to go from here to here standing beside the person with the question. Because that is different. When we talk about communities, we talk about community engagement, it's really easy to talk about, we've got a person, they go out, we do sessions. We do a poll on a regular basis. We love our community. It's very different to be beside your community and to admit that you don't know. We talked in the early days about the greedy librarian problem. You say, greedy librarians? Back to a budget discussion? No. It's a reference librarian issue. If you go up and you ask a reference librarian a question, hey, can you tell me, do you have this, etc. That reference librarian, I mean, if I went up and I said something to the effect of, I'm really interested in learning about what it's like to live in Sarasota, and the mayor was sitting next to the librarian, the librarian would say, well, let me go look something up for you. If they were standing next to Albert Einstein and I said, I'm curious about relativity, they would go, I'll be with you in a moment, sir. And they would come over, and by God, they would have a live guide built by the end of the day on relativity. It's that, but it's our service. It's not from greed, it's from the idea that I must serve you. I'm inadequate if I do not answer your question. My favorite reference question, I heard this on NPR, was, do clams sleep? Said, this reference I read said, it took me 20 years, by God, but I finally found it out. And the answer was, well, they sort of go dormant a little bit. This idea that we are with our community, we're learning, we're a part of, we're connected, that's what sort of, you know, we looked at this in education, constructivism, the idea that people construct knowledge. The old model, we called it the brick model. You guys are buckets. I throw bricks. So bricks of knowledge go out and get lodged in your buckets. And let's be honest, having worked with many undergraduates over the years, some buckets are a little narrower. But that's not how it works, right? It doesn't work that way. I can be brilliant, clearly I am, at what I do. And if you don't care, it doesn't matter. Right? You are in charge of whether you get something out of it. I can do my best to present it, to organize it, and that's my responsibility, but ultimately, it's the learner who's in charge of it. That's a big shift. That's a
huge shift in how academia thinks about it, how K-12 education, if you had to go through corporate training, which we're now a part of today, right? The oh, don't kill them with PowerPoint stuff, right? We try to change how we do it. So this idea of how do people interpret news and not everyone gets it the same way, that's not new. But it's very, very pronounced currently. Looking and thinking about how do we deal with agencies that have been traditionally presented as authority models when suddenly there's this healthy level of skepticism. And how do we deal with this? How do we confront the fact, and we're in Florida, how do we confront the fact that there may be some political divisions that aren't quite as narrow as they used to be? How do we have this lovely idea of working with our community when our communities are no longer around a single variable with an agreement of how they send out scarce resources? That's the real challenge. The real challenge that we have as librarians and agencies that work with them and cultural heritage institutions and people who believe that our job is to weave and build and maintain the fabric of a community. How do we respond when that community is tearing at that fabric on a regular basis, that is challenging that fabric on a regular basis, that has different views of what even that fabric should look like? That's the key challenge. It's not collections, it's not books, it's not programming, it's not technology, it's not makey-makey. It's the fact that two people can be from the same area and have totally diametrically consensus about what the truth is. That's what we have to begin to challenge. So, that happened. And what has been the response if we look into the library community and say, all right, how do we deal with this? And if you follow it on Twitter and you look around at what's happening, you see three pretty big classes of response, right? Response number one is information literacy. If only they knew. I was editing a call for proposals around fake news. We're going to do a fake news story. And they used the phrase, what do we do with a gullible community? Right, yeah. What do we do with the morons who, right, that's what they might as well have just said that. And so it was my boss. So I wrote, I circled it and I sent it back with a very nice message that said, maybe not the best word, I said, because one, this is a little blamey victim, and two, the ultimate response is to take them from gullible to skeptical. That what we need to do is we need to make people less trusting. You know, we need, if only our people were much more sarcastic and horrible, and because that's my aspiration for my 16 and 13-year-old is that they'll grow up and not trust anyone. That's really where I'm going for. So we'll talk about this, right? But the idea is we need to educate quickly. Teach them how to look at web resources. Teach them how to question facts. Give them the instruction. And this is a call that's gone out from academic libraries and school libraries and public libraries, and that's how we're going to respond to this current environment. The other is, and these aren't necessarily independent, but the other is promotion of quality. We need to present to them the good stuff. We need to make it very clear to people as they're seeking out information, as they're making decisions, whether they be political decisions or whether it be hobby decisions or reading decisions or whatever, we need to be the quality place. They need to trust us because we've got the good stuff. And the third one is the idea of we're neutral. In all of this partisan bickering and all of this marching and all of this yelling and all of this signage and whatever, the role of the library is the last bastion of neutrality in a community. No. So now my job is to tell you why none of those are right. And none of those are what's going to work. And so let's pick on the easiest one, information literacy. Information literacy is that idea that we can train people to determine what's fake news from right news, what's authoritative, where it's authoritative. The problem with this approach is not, I'm not against information literacy. I'm really not. I like information literacy a lot. I teach it. But fake news, propaganda, hyper-partisanship is actually a result of information literacy and requires sophisticated literacy tools. What that means is if you, depending on how you felt about the last election, if you felt that people were somehow snookered,
I don't know if that's an official term. If some people were conned or whatever, you cannot say it was lack of information that led to those decisions. You know, I have an uncle who lives in Apopka, and I love him. We have very bad dinner conversations, right? And the reason is we don't agree. But it's not because he's stupid, and it's not because he's uninformed, and it's not because he didn't go out and search information, and it's not because he doesn't have ready access to information. You saw a huge number of people who ran to the internet and got on the internet. We just didn't necessarily like where they went. But it's not because people weren't literate. They sought out that information. They were active on Facebook, on Twitter. They were sharing information on a regular basis. They were using all the tools we wanted to. At the same time, the people who were attempting to influence it on both sides, let me be really clear, in the last election on the Democrat side and the Republican side, they were complex, sophisticated consumers and users and manipulators of information. There were people who had expertise in this, and they had a playbook that was produced out of the library and information science community that they could follow. Let us be really clear about that. If you were to look at the Journal of the Association for Science and Information Technology, one of the premier journals in the library and information science, for the past 5 years, you have a brilliant playbook on how to manipulate people's information seeking. Right? We get things like the crap test. I love the crap test. I know you can't read it from the back. It's okay, you're not missing anything. This is the crap test. I didn't make this up. The crap test is how we're supposed to give someone a tool so that they can understand whether this is useful information or bad information. That's great. So what they're supposed to do, for example, is look at the currency of the information. Does it have a date on it? Is it relatively recent? When did it come out? Makes good sense. Look at the relevance. Is this actually on topic or not on topic? Look at the authority, where it's the source of this information. Look at its accuracy. Look at its purpose. They're great. I'm not going to argue with those. That'd be great. So 12 hours later, after you get that tweet from my uncle who talks about the fact that Native Americans are massing in, you know, the Bahamas to take over the world in an armed assault, you know, 12 hours later after I can disprove that, I can get to the rest of my life, right? The other thing is, this is a wonderful blueprint. If anyone is today looking to start the rumor that David Lankus wants the Supreme Court spot, put up a website with today's date on it, make it relevant because everyone cares what I'm going to do in the court, be an authority, you can just claim you're from an authority, it really doesn't matter. I speak from the Sarasota Times Tribune. I don't know what that is, right? Make sure it's accurate. And hide your purpose. Right? Think about that. Every tool we give to evaluate is a tool to use to manipulate. And by the way, really reputable sites, we were just once again talking in the wings, Apple Computer. If you go to apple.com, you won't find a date on it. You won't find, you know, relevance is whether you found it or not. And a lot of good, important websites don't follow this as well. So the sort of blanket wish that we can educate ourselves out of this is not realistic. It's important. We should do it. The other thing that we have to understand about information literacy, let's see if I can go back here for a moment, is we've done study after study after study. And what it shows is when you take people in, students, K-12, general public, and you run them through an information literacy course where for an hour we pound into your head the importance of information, you know what happens? People walk out of that feeling like they have a much better understanding and they are much better at evaluating information resources. And they're not. What we have found in study after study is that information literacy courses, workshops, and instruction lead to people's increased feeling of expertise without a corresponding increase in expertise. What we've done is not help them at all, but made them feel much better about it. That's a problem. So we have to be careful about this idea that somehow we can educate our way out of it. I don't want to say, clearly as someone who runs a school, education's unimportant. It's not. It's part of the formula, but it is not a panacea. We cannot force people through information literacy and then everyone will agree this is how the world should be. Not going to happen. How about the promotion of quality, that our job here will be to only get the good stuff? We will be the place people will come. We'll be the filter. This shows up in a lot of different, this is LibGuides. This is the idea of we're going to create yet another set of web pages you can trust and another set of links. You see this in school libraries all the time. School librarians are great. I don't know where they find the time to come after list and list and list of authoritative resources, particularly when they change every 2 minutes. Right? In the early days of the internet, In the early days of the internet, everyone was buying domains and putting up websites because it was going to make them millions of dollars, right? This was in, you know, 97. And so librarians were out there making links and lists. And then what happened is people realized that, in fact, it's not as simple to make money, so they'd all go out of businesses, and they'd have these domain names up that people were going to on a regular basis, and the porn sites bought them all the URLs. So suddenly librarians had really great links to really good porn, but I don't think that's what they wanted. Just saying. Promotion of quality, that idea that we have good stuff. Let's look at the reality of this. This first quote, thus visual appeal. So this is when you design a website. Visual appeal can be assessed within 50 milliseconds, suggesting that web designers have about 50 milliseconds to make a good first impression. When someone looks at your website, before their cognitive process can kick in, their visual cortex has already determined whether it's good or bad. Right? This becomes a real problem because we know that this isn't just whether they like the site, it also is whether they trust the site. This is instantaneous. This is before, you know, forget the crap test. This is the and you're done. Right? We know that there's the idea of confirmation bias. That is, what you think is a really good resource, when someone looks at it and goes, oh, no. Right? We know that, for example, quality, we could talk about quality, but it's contextual. And I have the Stormfront website. The Stormfront website is a website that, in essence, recruits white supremacists. By the way, not a new site, been there for a long time. I'm going to argue that it is an excellent, excellent resource. Not because I'm a white supremacist, let me be very clear about that. It's a great website if you have a reporter who walks up and says, I need a good website that represents the white supremacist community. I need a good website that talks about how the white supremacists recruit people online. That is a good resource for that question. 10th grader looking for after-school program? Not so much. That's our problem, is we can agree on what's a fact and not a fact all we want, but we can't agree on how that fact means something, is interpreted by something. I had a person, we were doing this in class, so I had a seniors in college, and I was putting up websites, and I'm like, is this a good site or a bad website? And they said, well, it's a bad one, I can't trust it. I said, why? It says, because it's got .com. I said, but it's newyorktimes.com. I mean, you know, the whole thing matters. And for some people, the .gov at the end makes it a questionable resource. Right? That context is really, 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 really important. So that concept that we can simply point our way out of this problem, that we will be the trusted resource, is problematic. It's a conversation discussion that we're having, that reporters are having. The idea of interpretation we're having with our humanities communities, we're having with our partners on all lines about how to respond to it. But the concept that we can only give the good stuff is problematic. All right, so I know I have some librarians in the room. Everyone else, close your eyes for a moment. Librarians, if you feel that 100% of the materials that you currently house in your library are high quality materials that you personally can attest to their veracity, could you raise your hands, please? In fact, there's no, it's like a Star Wars quote, there's no greater bastion of lies and misrepresentation and horror than a good academic library, right? That's what it's there for. It's there to not only talk about what is, but what was, and what was agreed to and not agreed to, opposing views. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way when you have this generic lean that we can only do the good stuff. We're not there. We've tried that. It didn't work. It didn't work, not simply because it was a pain, but it didn't work because it doesn't match reality. I mean, this is my favorite cartoon of the whole day, right? Well, is that cup half empty or half full? It's always full. This is, geek, yeah? But my point of that is, fact. No? Which fact do you want? It's not that either of those are wrong, or are they're all about interpretation, they're about context, they're about sensitivity. So this concept that librarians are going to become arbiters of truth, two people should worry about being arbiters of truth. The clergy and philosophy students, not librarians. Good information is always contextual. It's always about the question, not about the resource. Okay. So what about then giving up? We're neutral. We don't care. Just don't bother us. You want Trump's book? You want Hillary's book? I don't care. My budget's big enough, I'll give you whatever you want. I still have a Ralph Nader book here somewhere. Hold on, I'll be right back. That's how we're going to survive this hyper-partisan, is we will rise above. Problem with rising above. First of all, does everyone realize, back to my English majors, that the Latin root for neuter is the same as neutral? Just saying. To be biased is to be human. Everyone in this room, I'm guessing, has a particular bias around libraries. We think they're a good thing. If not, why are you here? Right? That's a bias. If you believe that tax dollars should be taken from the entire community to use to build community resources, for whatever reason, that's a perspective. And trust me, I've been to Northern Maine. It is not a universally held opinion. They don't even want to pay for frickin' roads. Right? Sewers? Bah, I'll make my own. So if not neutral, because we don't want to be the neutered profession. This is from my journalism colleagues, Ernie Wiggins, fabulous journalism professor. We had this lovely lunch and we talked about fake news and all these things. And he said there's a difference between neutrality and objectivity. Objectivity means the notion of being testable, that we can be objective, that we can take something and we can test it, we can try it out. Or at least we're intellectually honest about it. We admit that we have these biases so that we can work against them. But and what's often held up is the notion of science. We should be more scientific. I'm a scientist. But many people misunderstand that science is not objective. Science is not neutral. Science is a belief system. Science is the belief system that they can never confirm truth. They can only seek to describe it and pursue it. Everything in science is falsifiable. Falsifiability is the core of the scientific method. It means if I tell you something and you can prove one instance that it doesn't affect it, I'm wrong, we discard it. That's why theories like relativity, theories like evolution, theories are so powerful, is that they've withstood this constant battering to disprove. But that's different than saying because they're true. Right? Take something, this is my favorite. This is Harper's Magazine from the 1950s, 1958, in which two scientists get up and talk about the fact that we are about to enter a global ice age. Oops. Now, this is very easy to put this slide up. I guess we're now up to 4 trigger warnings. To say, does that mean Dave is questioning whether global climate? No, I think that we are, in fact, in massive climate change and we're killing our world. All right, there's my political thing. Feel free to walk out. But I walked by a tank that talked about being the manatee community. So come on, you guys want to save a manatee? They're going to eventually be swimming over your streets. But the point of falsifiability is they went through a method, they made an assertion, it was disproved, we move on. That's the context, right? I believe in the scientific method and objectivity, but let's be honest, it is not an unnuanced conversation. It's very easy not only to say, well, it was snowed in Washington, D.C. Clearly, there is no global warming. I live in Colombia. There's global warming. If you've ever been in August in Colombia, not only is there global warming, there's global humidification. Swimming to your car in the morning. Right? This idea that we have to talk about, well, we're objective, I agree. But it's not, once again, not an unnuanced conversation. It opens you up, if you try and have the, this is what the scientists say, this is what the fact is, it opens it up to the questioning side, it opens up to alternative, it's not a slam dunk conversation, if I will. So, And here's the other trigger warning. This is the most depressing slide I have.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me today.
Someday I'm going to do that.
Yay. All right. Braveheart time. Freedom! No, all right. Why do I think librarians are the answer? I think that if you look at the core of what librarians do and libraries do, and you look at how they're functioning, they provide another way of doing it. In essence, we've been doing the right thing all along. We need to step up our game and do more of it and understand it at a much core concept. So let's start with the library lie. How many libraries do I have in the audience today? None. Put your hands down. You're not a building. Right? What is a library? It can shield you from the rain and exert gravity. That's what it can do. It can decay and cause budget problems. But it's the people within the libraries that are going to make this a solution. So let me be really clear. This isn't about simply we need more buildings with library on the front. We need more people who are dedicated to understand the values and principles of librarianship. By the way, I have a very broad definition of librarian. I don't just mean people who get a master's of library science. By the way, you should get a master's of library science, and you should do it from the University of South Carolina, School of Library Information Science. The Knowledge School. All right. But I have the hit by a bus test for librarianship. If you're hit by a bus in the morning and the library can't open, you're a librarian. Right? That idea that, so if I use the word librarian and you're sitting there going, but I'm only a paraprofessional, just go with it. I'm talking to you too. The idea of someone who's dedicated to you know looking at information, has the principles, the values, the theories of it. So a library is not the people. A library is a mandated and facilitated space supported by the community, stewarded by librarians, and dedicated to knowledge creation. Let me parse for a moment. It's a mandated space. Simply opening up a door and saying, I'm a library, doesn't work. Someone's got to care. Someone's got to worry about it, right? So a mandated in public library context might be the idea of some legislation or charter or some act that creates it. It's facilitated space, so it's not just the big empty room full of books. Everyone, by the way, know the difference between a librarian and a pathological hoarder? Librarians use canvas bags. That's not it, right? It's not just the fact, we got a lot of stuff, let's call it a library, doesn't work. We have to worry about how is it organized? Do we have high shelves, low shelves? Do we have open spaces, loud, quiet? That's an act of work, right? That takes insight, that takes professionalism. So it's not just mandated and it's there, it's mandated and cared for. Supported by the community. Supported in terms of having trustees, having board members, having friends groups, also supported in terms of tax dollars or what have you. So it's got to be something that the community wants and pays for. There's got to be some pain to a library. There's got to be a decision about a library. It is stewarded by librarians, not owned. Librarians make libraries in the sense that they are stewards. They have a responsibility. They make a decision. Professional nature, all of that is important. And dedicated to knowledge creation. Why do we have libraries? I have a lot of people when I talk about it's about learning and knowledge creation, they go, well, what about haven and quiet space? Absolutely. But havens and quiet spaces don't happen by accident. They are thoughtful, and we put them there for a reason. And the larger intent is to make sure that our communities have the necessary space and aspiration to learn. And some libraries are going to be loud, and some are going to be quiet, and some are going to have apparently roller coasters in them. But that idea of decisions and stewardship happen. Now, the reason I bring this up and the reason I say libraries, what's the alternative to information literacy and neutrality and quality? And that's the idea that what librarians do is they weave together community understandings. They weave together and caretake, steward, the knowledge zeitgeist, if you will, of a community. I know we look at it as we serve, we provide, we distribute, we disseminate. But the true value of a library is we invite, we connect, we combine, we share. That idea is not neutral. I'll give you an example. Wayne Wiegand, if you have not read his book on Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library, go read it. Brilliant book. It's about the history of the public library. Many people, for example, don't realize that the public library movement in the United States grew out of the same movement as public education. The fight to bring our children out of factories and put them into schools also recognized the idea that once you're done at the end of a day as an adult with a factory, you also needed a school. You needed a place to learn, and that was the public library. Same social movement. Carnegie, when he built libraries, primarily to keep the mob from tearing him apart because he's a steel industrialist, but he's Scottish, so it's okay, because I'm half Scottish myself, was the idea that he wanted his workers to know what was going on, to be good citizens. If we're going to run a democracy, we must have an informed citizenry to do it. But around the turn of the 18th to 19th century, libraries were envisioned very much as a traditional learning institution. And there was a blight on the community that was happening in libraries. Back in the day, public libraries were destroying the fabric and moral compass of society. Congratulations. Good job. The pornography of the day, anyone want to guess?
Novels.
Literary novels. Our libraries are now stocking fiction. Now, the reason I bring this up is today, that sounds crazy. It's so fundamental. Of course, we do love of reading and fiction and materials. It's so core to what we do. But 100 years ago, it was not. In fact, I love this quote. School children, factory and shop girls, men and who tended bar, drove carriages and worked on farms and boats, and finally, fallen women. And in general, the denizens of the midnight world, night owls, prowlers, and those who apparently live upon sin and its wages. That quote was in a California newspaper, and the idea of that's what literary novels do. That's who these things appeal to. My point of this story is at that point, society had a very clear definition of what was knowledge and what was not knowledge, and it was out of sync with what librarians were doing. And the reason 100 years later, we can sit there and go, really? Jane Eyre? By the way, my particular one is not the sin of wages. It's the idea that men who tend bar. It's like Tom Cruise in Cocktail. Yeah, I was reading Jane Eyre the other day, and I'm telling you, that's a hell of a book there. Last call, first page. Okay. It took a discussion with society. It took action. It took a point of view and a conversation and collaboration and arguments. And over the years, not solely libraries, but we have changed the concept of what a library is. We have changed the fact that this was seen as the negative to this is now the positive. That was a proactive action, right? And so what we need to understand is that knowledge, this truth, the anti-truth, is social. Information seeking is about trust. Study after study says the place you go to get an answer is the place you trust. And it is almost always, by the way, a friend, roommate, right? We want Jasmine West, I love how she says this. She says, our goal is to make librarians into friends because then we become part of that trusted circle. And trust does not come from neutrality, but consistency. You don't trust this beautiful theater. You don't. It doesn't change. It doesn't vary. It doesn't comment on what you're wearing today. It doesn't argue whether I should sing or not. You don't trust it. It just is. You trust someone where they are consistently right. They give you a consistent answer. They have a track record. And by the way, sometimes you trust things because they're consistently wrong. I know it sounds weird. But when I was going through a doctoral program, Mary McKenna was going with me, and we both loved movies. We saw movies as many times as we could. I mean, literally, my dissertation topic came as if from sunlight above while I was watching a Clint Eastwood movie in a theater. I don't know. But I'd always ask her, Mary, what's your favorite movie that's out today? And the reason I wanted to know is because I would not want to see it. And she'd ask me the same thing, because quite frankly, mine would involve explosions, and hers would involve deep thought. And I had enough of that during the day. But that consistency, that we understand it, that we know what's happening, right? So we know that knowledge is social, that it's from consistency, and we're seeing this move to credibility as reliability over authority. What does that mean? How many people have ever gone to a website to look at the Doppler radar to see if it's going to rain? This is the interactive portion of our day. Keep your hands up. Hands up. Come on. All right. Would all of the licensed, educated meteorologists please keep your hands up? We look now at information sources we never did before. Yes, we can listen to the weather guy, but who trusts the weather guy? Particularly in Florida. Good God. It's going to be dry today, except for that 2 minutes, in which case we're going to be underwater for an hour and a half. That idea of how we learn, it's from people who are being consistent, it's from people we know, it's from a personal connection. So back to that community thing, back to that idea of the librarian moving from behind the desk to in front of the desk, that is a way of building credibility. When Justin had broken building the 3D printer, he was building credibility. Obviously not as a 3D printer constructor, but because he was saying, I'm like you, I can trust you. I'm going to show you who I am. I'm going to connect. That's not serving a community. That is being a community. And that's the big thing. Every librarian's job, whether it's at the front desk or whether it's in the back office, and preferably whether it's on the streets of the city, you are in the community outreach business because you are the community. We know that, for example, this is a study that Maine did. Maine went out and they asked for, what are the most trusted professions out there? Number one, nurses, not doctors. Interesting. Nurses. Now, someone who's had a little run-in with some medical issues in their life, I know what that comes from. Doctor comes in and says, congratulations, you got cancer. See you tomorrow. That literally happened. Nurses are sitting there going, okay, it's okay. So this is true story, not to slam every doctor. I had Hodgkin's lymphoma, congratulations. And what happened was, after months, a doctor came in, sat down and said, we believe that you have Hodgkin's lymphoma. We have to do a bone marrow biopsy to see whether it spread to your bone marrow, and the lab closes in an hour, so we need you to lie down on the bed as we begin to, in essence, thrust this pin into your shoulder. And they kicked my wife out. As I'm getting this, a nurse walks up to the head of the bed, grabs my hand, and begins talking to me. So, where are you going? What's your favorite place? Do you have a good vacation place? So, your wife's nice. What does she do? As soon as that pin came out of my hip, she dropped my hand, very nicely, walked out, walked down to the lounge where my wife was, and she looked at my wife and she said, look, you're planning this funeral. Stop it. And she walked through. This is what's going to happen. This is how it's going to occur. That authority wasn't simply a matter of she knew the process. She knew the people. She knew the purpose. As a great librarian, we spend a lot of time on your skills. We spend a lot of time on how you search things and apply metadata and understand schemas. We need to spend a little bit more time on you as an instrument and your emotional quotient, your ability to connect emotionally. Librarians are number two. Pharmacists, medical doctors, they're still there. They saved my life, fine. High school teachers, by the way, I love that. High school teachers. Screw the elementary school teachers. Police officers, clergy. Just wondering, 20 years ago, if that might have been a little higher. Funeral directors. I guess, you know, like, what are you going to screw up? Let's be honest. And then accountants. Good Lord. Anyway, stay at the top. The top is good. Stay up at the top. Right? And so what we're talking about here, and I'm going a little long, but I will move it along. What we need to talk about is librarians need to make and facilitate communities. We need to engage them. We need to talk to them. And we do that in specific ways. We do that through motivation. We assume that people who walk into a public library are already motivated to know what they know. Don't assume it. Figure out what is it that motivates them. How do you give that power? And the number one motivating factor for any human being on the world is ownership. The idea of having them come in and say, I'm going to serve you because you are wrong or you're ignorant, because I haven't educated you yet, is the most offsetting thing. To say, I don't know, what do you know? Hey, let's try this. Let's have someone come in and speak and do a session for us. Think about it for a moment. Someone walks up to the reference desk. We ask the question, how may I help you? And that sounds beautiful. But if you interpret it in a certain way, it's one of the most arrogant statements we can make. How can I help you? Because clearly, you need help. And I do not. Now, I know that's not how we intended, and I've had people go, well, what should I say? And my one is always, hey, what are you passionate about today? Because if you ask someone what they're passionate about, what are they learning? Hey, what are you doing today? What you're doing is you're, in essence, inviting yourself into their process, not asking them to come to your process. Because the truth is, and we all know this, right? Number one question never to ask, right? It used to be, why do you need to know this? We weren't allowed to do that. That's crazy. Number two is, have you searched Google? Do I breathe? Yeah. But we need to say, they probably know more about this topic already than you do. I mean, they may be completely blank, but they've probably done some struggling with it before they've walked up to a desk, for God's sake, to talk to a stranger and admit they don't know something. This is crazy. Think about that model. Hi. In public, behind furniture. This is great. What are you passionate about? What are you learning? How do we motivate them? And we do that by giving them something to do. We give them some engagement. We provide access. We love access. Access to materials. Access to materials. We're great at that. But do we give access to other people within the community who may know and care about those issues as well? Do we bind people together? Are we the loom of our communities that stitch together the social and knowledge fabric? Do we teach them and train them? Oh, here's the material that's in Mandarin. Would you like to know about our language courses? Right? That idea of providing development, providing education, providing training. And we do it in an environment of safety. A public library should be a safe space to explore dangerous ideas. Right? That's what we do with our Library Bill of Rights. That's what we do with our privacy. That idea that, look, we don't know where the next brilliant idea is going to come from, and so we don't censor, we don't block it down, and you should feel safe doing it, physically safe and intellectually safe. And we're doing this, we're stitching together a community. We're bringing together a community so that they understand what we're doing. And so rather than going through the rest of the slides, they're lovely, you won't miss them. Think about what your role is. Your role as a librarian. Your institutional role as a library, your role as a trustee, as a friends group, as a partner, is to weave together what a community believes and aspires to. The answer to it is not to tell people are wrong and give them education. The answer is not to determine what is wrong and right and simply give them your view of right. The answer is not to be neutral and not worry about right. The answer is to engage your community and say, what do we think about this? And it's hard. Because you have people that don't agree. And why do we talk about civil spaces, civic spaces? Why do we talk about safe spaces? Why do we talk about havens? It's because we want to be that glue that brings people together so that someone who fundamentally disagrees, we can at least at this point talk. We may never agree, but at least we can agree to talk. That's what our solution is. Now, the reporters are trying to do that, but they're doing lots of fact-checking on the sides. And we have lots of professional organizations and facilitations trying to do that. But the role of a library, the role of librarians, the role of our profession is fundamentally suited to a community understanding of reality. That what we're doing is we talk about not the problems of our communities, but the aspirations of our communities. We talk about what do we want to be? Do we want to be a cultured community that thrives and believes in history and reading and literature and action and drama, and we are a learned and cultured society? Do we want to be an economic powerhouse that pumps out startups? Do we want to be a quiet space? Do we want to be a startup and innovation space? There is no answer to what is a library. It's just like the truth. It's contextual, it's constructed. And it doesn't happen on its own. It takes guidance and it takes someone to pull it together. And so ultimately, what librarianship is about is the highest aspirations we have as a country.
To govern ourselves is to come to consensus and figure out what it is to be governed. What are the rights? What are the responsibilities? What is the truth may vary, but we should at least have an ongoing conversation about it. And we can provide a space like no other institution in the country can do. That is an amazing and awesome responsibility. But we are perfectly situated to do it. We understand how to do this. We have trust with our communities. We are linked to our communities. We are of the communities. And that's what it comes down to. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time today.
Oh, if we got time. I know I'm running late, but
questions, thoughts, trigger warnings? I can't see you right now.
Yes, please. I see a couple of things. I think that we adapt very well. I think we always are based on a core principle, that the goal, that the mission of a librarian, and therefore that's the institutions we steward, is to improve society, and the way in which we improve society is we help people learn. Right? I mean, cops say that they improve society through security, firemen through security and life-saving, right? We have these different ways. We do it specifically in helping people learn. As do schools. That's why we have great partnerships. These are two, I was going to talk briefly, these are two strategic plans. The first one I'll bring up really quickly is from Topeka, Kansas, so out in Gina Millsap's shop. Brilliant. This is their strategic plan. Within their strategic plan, they include the following goals that a library will have on their community. One, every child will be ready for kindergarten. Two, everyone will discover a passion for learning. Three, everyone will continue learning in new ways and live their best lives. Four, Topeka and Shawnee County will be an engaged community of readers. Five, the library will be a learning organization committed to excellent leadership planning focus. We will do books really well. We believe that learning is important. I understand those. These came by having a discussion with United Way that led to the idea of Take the readiness for kindergarten. One of the things they found is, yes, we can provide lots of materials and some literacy sessions and story times, but this particular area of the city that needs lots of that, they can't get to the library because there's no bus line and they have a transportation issue, which, by the way, is an economic issue and leads to jobs. So to come up with this plan, they had to bring the bus system in to be part of their strategic plan. So my answer to you is, rather than us looking like we're constantly adapting to what a community's doing, this is much more organic, where we are trying to figure out as a community what we're doing and what part we can play. This one is from the Richland County Public Library. Goal one, to help create a strong and resilient economy. Goal two, strengthen community cohesion. Goal three, transform educational outcomes for the youth. Goal four, help break a cycle of poverty. How did this come about? Wasn't a bunch of librarians sitting in the back room going, I hate poverty, let's do something. I'm all for poverty. White supremacists, poverty, all right, we're good. They sat for a year with sheriffs, they sat with a year with the mayor, they sat with mayors, this is a county system, they sat with community leaders, elders. So the strategic plan here, while it says it's under the library, is truly a community strategic plan around knowledge and learning. The next future of the library, I can't tell you if it looks like roller coasters or maker spaces, because I don't know. What does your community look like? But I'll tell you that every library should have a strategic plan, which is jointly constructed with the community around the community aspirations. And that turns into learning much more than materials and books. I'm all for books. They're great tools. Buildings, great tools. But if we're about learning, for your community, that tool might be an aquarium. That tool might be a 3D printer. That tool might be bringing community members to talk and speak on areas. So the future, I know it's not very specific, but the future is really this idea of community level strategic planning and implementation for services. It's about strong collaborations, not just as an added on extra, but really blurring the boundary. And it's a hell of a lot more librarians leaving the building and the community coming into the building than the other way around. That community built, that library building we used to have was where librarians did their work. Now it's where the community comes to do its work, and the librarians, because we have lovely things like this, we're out in the community serving the needs for those who can't make it in the building. So, some trends. Other questions, thoughts?
Any other questions?
Up here.
Oh, hello. Oh,
hi.
Do you have vertigo? I wrote a great book. The greatest book. Called Expect More, but anyway, so yes. A couple of things around literacy and bringing it. First, we need to understand you need to start where a community is, not where you want it to go. So for example, talking with someone who has strong, John Palfrey wrote a great book called Bibliotech. See, I can push other people's books too. And in it, he identifies one of the major barriers to the advancement of libraries as nostalgia. And he talks about the idea that a nostalgic view of libraries is holding us back. We need a new nostalgia. I had a school librarian who was talking about the fact that she needed more resources for a school. She said, look at the board. I was at a board meeting. She said, look at the board. I said, yes. She said, the average age of a school board is around mid-late 40s. By the way, the average age of volunteer boards, above 50, approaching 60. They said, now here's the problem with the school board. The last time they used a school library was almost 30 years ago. It was a different place 30 years ago, and they haven't been there since. And the school library, particularly because if they do go there, it's creepy and it's probably illegal, right? This idea, though, when we look at community members, their last encounter with the library might have been 30 years ago then. And so they have this view, I was served so well, I love the library. It's a positive impact that it had in their life. But it wasn't maintained, and that nostalgia becomes a source of problems. So, a couple of things to think about. One, build on the nostalgia. You need to start there and build them elsewhere. You love the library, right? Oh, I smelled books, which is fungus. I love the wood, which is mold. And then there's this great librarian and I hooked up with a girlfriend. I don't know. Start with that, go, yes. And you learn so much. By the way, learning is important. You know how else we learn? We learn through makerspaces, whatever. Where are you trying to get them to? Think of the themes. And don't ever use the idea of we're more than just books. There's a great psychologist who I'm not getting his name off of that, but he wrote another great book called Don't Think of an Elephant. And he's a democratic political strategist, so be warned. But he's also a cognitive linguist. And he talks about how we retain words. And the idea is if you use the word over and over again, it sticks in your head. And the problem is that nuance tends to disappear. So when Richard Nixon was out there saying, I am not a crook, and there was all this discussion about how Richard Nixon was a crook, the brain went, I am not a crook, I'm a crook, right? We reinforce these terms. I'll give you another example. Close your eyes. Don't think of the color red. By starting with the, we're more than just books, what you're really doing is reinforcing we're books. And then this other stuff is like icing on the top. So a narrative around learning and community engagement is a much more successful. Because just like people can't be, you know, boy, you know, poverty's great, that doesn't happen. Boy, learning sucks. That, you know, this is a positive message that fits and is a much more broader image. So you want to start where they are, you want to bring learning into it, you want to avoid the more than just books, and you want to talk about engagement and aspirations of a community. Stop telling everyone what's wrong with them. Our readership, you know, we've got this literacy rate problem, we have this problem, this problem, this problem. Not that we're not going to solve them, but put them in an aspirational context. If we want to be a literate cultured community of Sarasota, then we need to make sure that people can read to do that.
But it's in the context of becoming a literate society, not because they can't read. So what are the aspirations of the community? And hit them again and again and again. So there are tools coming out. The Aspen Report is a great piece that you can use as well with some advocacy tools. I know Sarasota is working with the Harwood Institute on community engagement. I have some expect more stuff. So there are tools out there that you can get your hands on to be a little bit more pragmatic, but there's some general themes.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Lankus. Let's give him a warm round of applause here. And thank you to our sponsor, VinTech Logic, for bringing you here. We're very happy to have you here, and thank you all for coming today.